Welcome to Ask JTF. I'm Chaim Ben Pesach from the Jewish Task Force. On this program every week, we attempt to answer questions from our great JTFers. But first, this program is dedicated to a refuah shlema, complete recovery, for Sharon Mitman, Shlomo Ben Sara, and Dorit Bat Sara, and to Ilui Neshamot, Elevating of the Souls, for Malka Bat Meir, Allegra Bat Shlomo, Daniel Nankin, Hadassa Bat Yitzchak, Victor Chazdai, Pesach Sev Ben Dov, Lunita Adler, Shifra Hoffman, Ruven Hoffman, Barry Hoffman, Harab Meir Kahana, Harab Binyamin Kahana, Tzipora Fegi Bat Liba, Yosef Ben Meir, Robert Mitman, Dennis Shore, Helen Friedman, and Charles Zolot. We are changing direction starting next week on the program. We're going to still have the Ask JTF program, but we're only going to accept two short questions from each person. It'll be two short questions per person. If someone asks more than two short questions, we won't be able to answer them. This week's program is still under the old system because we announced it in the middle of the week and it wouldn't be fair to change it in the middle of the week. But starting on next week's Ask JTF, it's going to be two short questions per person. Why? Because before we had to place a 300 character limit on all posts. If we didn't, people would be asking 50 questions, that's what happened in the past, and I literally was doing three-hour programs in the past. So in order to prevent a situation where we were going to have Ask JTF programs that will be 3 or 4 hours every week, we have to put some sort of limit on the questioning. People did not like the 300-character limit because we had to put the 300-character limit on the entire JTF forum. We couldn't do it just on the thread with the questions. We had to do it because of our stupid software that we have on our forum. They make us do it on either all the threads or none of the threads. And people didn't like the 300-character limit, so we have eliminated the 300-character limit. Now you don't have a character limit on your threads. You can now post freely throughout the forum without any limit whatsoever. But on the programs, on the SJTF programs, we're only going to answer the first two short questions. If people ask more than two short questions, once again, we will not be able to answer them. And in addition to that, people have asked how they can contribute to the Hilltop Youth, Noar HaGevaot, which is the group of heroic Jewish youth in Judea and Samaria that JTF is supporting. And JTF is the only organization in the United States or anywhere in the world that is officially, regularly supporting the Hilltop Youth and sending them financial support and backing them up. We're the only organization doing it, and that's a disgrace. We want other organizations to join us and do it, but so far no one else is doing it. And people have asked, how can they help the Hilltop Youth? But first, I just want to say something about the Hilltop Youth. One of the Hilltop communities, there are dozens of Hilltop communities, and one of the Hilltop communities, one of the more established ones, is called Ge'ulat Zion. And Ge'ulat Zion is a beautiful community where they have families and children. And they had a very nice thing going there, and they were trying to expand the community. And what happened was, unfortunately, because of, I don't know if it's jealousy or petty hatred or whatever the reason is, but Amichai, which is the settlement near the community, cut their water off. They just cut their water off. Now, Amichai was formed when Amona was destroyed. There was a Jewish settlement called Amona, which the evil Netanyahu Likud government destroyed. The Netanyahu Likud government destroyed Amona. And they went in and said to the people in Amona, you have to surrender, and if you surrender, we'll move your settlement somewhere else, which was a terrible thing to sue, a terrible surrender, because their settlement was moved to a less strategic area, and it's a terrible precedent. It means that they're willingly accepting retreat from the land of Israel. Very, very bad precedent. So the cowardly leaders of Amichai and the maskirut there, the directorate there, are a bunch of cowards. These cowardly traitor leaders there agreed to pick up and move and surrender without a fight. And it was a terrible precedent, and it hurt all the Jews in Judea and Samaria and hurt the whole settlement movement. Now these same wimpy zeros have decided to maliciously cut off the water that was going to this hilltop community, Gehulat Zion. The winter season is starting and it's cold. They're on a mountain. It's cold. They have little children there. They have children and babies and families there. And they cut off the water supply to them at a time like this, when the cold weather is starting. If this had happened to an Arab Nazi village, an Arab village filled with Arab Muslims who want to destroy Israel and the Jewish people, there'd be an outcry. Everybody would be screaming and yelling, how can you do this? This is a disgrace. It's inhumane. And they would never do it to an Arab village. And they would never do it to an Arab city. But Amichai, which is supposed to be a settlement, but they're part of, you know, they're part of the leadership in the settlement movement. And by the way, all the residents of Amichai, some of the residents there do support the Jews in Ge'ulat Zion. The residents who do support the Jews, you're wonderful people, we love you. But the leadership there, the directorate there, are low-life traitors. Good-for-nothing, stinking traitors. This is what they do to Jewish children in wintertime. This is how they're trying to destroy the Jewish settlement movement. What is this petty nonsense? What could possibly be the reason? What did they do wrong to you that you do this to them, that you're cutting off their water supply? They're trying to save they're sacrificing and trying to save the Jewish people from an Arab takeover of Judea and Samaria, which would be national suicide for the Jewish people, and you cut off their water supply? This is the type of challenges. This is the type of challenge that we face all the time there. Constantly. This is constantly happening, these types of challenges. This is the same settlement. Ge'ulat Zion, by the way, is a settlement where the last time they came to destroy the settlement, the police and the border guards, what's known as the Magavnikim, the Mishmar HaGvul, the border guards, they were pulling girls' hair. Jewish teenage girls who live on the settlements were passively resisting their attempt to destroy their homes and destroy their settlement. And so they were just sitting on the ground passively resisting. And the police and the border guards came and sprayed them with massive amounts of tear gas. They emptied canisters, full canisters of tear gas in their faces. And they got pneumonia from inhaling so much tear gas, these girls. One of them was in the hospital with pneumonia because of it. And they dragged them away by their hair, pulling them by their hair. And brutally, violently expelling these Jews from their homeland in order to try to placate the Arabs and the self-hating Jews that don't want Jews living in their own homeland. Mainly the self-hating Jews. These are heroes. These are noble people who are often stabbed in the back by their fellow Jews. We won't be silent and we're not going to stand by and watch this. JTF is there to support them. JTF's the only group that will support the Hilltop Youth. I don't know right now. I'm going to speak to them. We're going to hopefully speak to them tomorrow. We're going to find out what their needs are and we're going to try to help them in whatever way we can. But this is the type of betrayals that they have to cope with, and JTF is there to help them, and we're proud to be there to help them. And when you support JTF, that's what you're supporting. Now, people have asked me, how do you support these people? What do you do and how do you contribute? There's some people who are not clear, because I don't make a big deal about this every week on the program. I just give the message and I'm hoping that people will look for themselves and find how to contribute. And, you know, I don't want to beat people over the head and ask them to contribute all the time. And I don't spend a lot of time doing that on the program, because I respect our JTF supporters, and I think our JTF supporters are intelligent enough to find information or ask about it. But, you know, it is reasonable to want to know where exactly you contribute, and we want to make it easy for people. There are two ways you can do it. One is through PayPal. We have a PayPal account. You have to go to the Hebrew main page. The Hebrew main page. Our Hebrew main page is hayamin.org. 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 And on the top of, that's all you need is hayamin.org. And on the top of hayamin.org, on the top, there's a line that says donation in English. The rest of the page is almost the whole page is in Hebrew because it's the Hebrew site. But you don't need a PayPal account for a one-time donation. If you want to make recurring donations, you will have to open up a PayPal account or have a PayPal account, which some people do. But if you just want to make a one-time donation, you don't need a PayPal account. You can do it right there, and it just a couple of clicks, and it's very easy to do. And all you do, again, if you want to get to that page for the donations through PayPal online, you just press on the donate button. It's in English. The button is in English, donate, on the top of hayamin.org of our Hebrew site, which is hayamin.org. That's one way to donate. The second way to donate, you can always send checks and money orders through the regular mail. And you sent it to our post office box. And our post office box, which you can also find, by the way, our post office box you can find on both the English and the Hebrew websites. And that post office box is JTF P.O. Box 650327, 650327, Fresh Meadows, New York, 11365. Let me repeat it again. JTF P.O. Box 650327, 650327, Fresh Meadows, New York, 11365. Okay, we got those announcements out of the way, and now we can get to our questions from our great JTFers. And we're going to start off with Ram 770, or 770, depending how you want to say it. In other words, Ram 770, who asked me in Hebrew questions. I'm going to answer them in English, Ram. אני אענה לך באנגלית כי אני לא רוצה רוב האנשים שלנו לא מבינים עברית. Most of our people don't speak Hebrew, and it's not fair to them for me to answer all the questions in Hebrew. So I'm going to read it and answer as quickly as I can in English in Hebrew. And Ram writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim Hayakar Mashlomcha, which is, Hello Chaim, how are you? Ma datcha al ze ani lomed b'yeshiva b'ramat ha-Golan. What is your opinion on the fact that I'm learning in the yeshiva in the Golan Heights? Ani sameach me'od. Kol hakavod yishar koach she'ata lomed Ram b'yeshiva b'ramat ha-Golan. More power to you. Wonderful that you're learning in the Golan Heights. And then he asks a question about the... Okay, I'm going to go into some of this. Uma datcha al ha'aravim yimach shmam v'zichram, or yimach shmam shekimat asu lynch al ha'shotrim b'kfar Kasem. And then Ram writes about a specific incident which took place in another place. He's asking me about lynches that Arabs, yimach shmam v'zichram, carried out on Jews. And he's saying that this is a lynch where they tried to carry out where they tried to lynch police in Kfar Kasem. It's called Kfar Kasem, this town. Ram zemochiach she'ein dukiyum im ha'aravim be'eretz Yisrael. Hem rotzim lehashmid otanu. Hem rotzim ot shoah. Hem hanatzim shel dorenu. ואין דו קיום וחייבים לעודד אותם לעזוב את ארץ ישראל לצמיתות. And what I just said is, this just proves there is no coexistence with the Arabs in the land of Israel. They want to destroy us, they want to murder us, and they want another Holocaust against us, and we've got to encourage them to leave the land of Israel. אני מודה לך, Ram. I thank you, Ram, for your questions. And now we go to the great Hirvatsky Noachide, who asks very, very good questions every week, and I see this week is another very interesting one. In Laws of Kings 9:1, Maimonides says that 6 precepts were commanded to Adam, and the 7th was added for Noah in Genesis 9:4. Tractate Sanhedrin 56b says that all of the Noahide commandments can be exegetically derived from Genesis 2:16. I'm sure I didn't say it right. Exegetically, I don't know how to say that. Hirvatsky, My ignorance is showing. I don't know how to say that. I'm sorry. I apologize. Okay, which derivation do you prefer and why? Okay, exegetically, maybe. Exegetically or... Okay. Anyway, I tried. Hrvatsky, very good question. What Hrvatsky is saying is that Harambam, Maimonides, Harambam is the Hebrew acronym for Maimonides, that Maimonides said that six of the commandments were given to Adam Harishon, to Adam, and the seventh was added for Noach, was added for Noach later on in Sefer Bereshit, in the book of Genesis. But it says in Tractate Sanhedrin, it says that all of the commandments can actually be derived from Genesis 2:16, earlier in the book of Genesis. So were all seven given earlier in the book of Genesis, or were six given to Adam and then a seventh added later in the book to Noah? Which derivation do you prefer and why is what Hrvatsky asks. Very interesting question. Hrvatsky, I don't really see a contradiction, or I think it's possible to interpret this without there being a contradiction between what Harambam says and what the Sanhedrin 56b tells us. Of course, there are different opinions sometimes, and sometimes there are contradictions between the rabbinic scholars and rabbinic sages and Torah scholars and Talmudic sages. That sometimes can happen. In this particular case, I don't see a real contradiction. I'll tell you why. I think that you can derive all seven commandments that were given to Bnei Noach in Genesis 2:16, in the earlier part of Genesis. I think all seven of them are there, and I think Harambam, I don't think he really said that the seventh one isn't there, but the seventh commandment, which is, the seventh commandment is Ever Min HaChai, which means eating from a live animal, tearing part of a live animal off and eating from a live animal, which is forbidden to the Gentiles, or to anybody, to Gentiles, Jews, it's one of the commandments that's forbidden. This seventh commandment was not applicable. This seventh commandment was dormant until after the Mabul, until after the flood. Because before the Mabul, before the flood in the time of Noach, people didn't eat animals. People were vegetarian. And so the commandment on what to do with animals was not, again, wasn't relevant. It wasn't germane. But after the flood, Hashem gave people permission to eat animals, and once they had permission to eat animals, we had to make sure that it wasn't being done in such a barbaric, inhumane way, where, you know, people used to tear the leg off a horse and then fry the leg of a horse while the horse was still alive, you know, rip organs off of animals and rip parts of animals that were still alive off of them in order to eat them. And this was very, very cruel to the animals, and we're not allowed to be cruel to the animals. Sa'ar balei chayim, causing sorrow to animals, is a sin in Judaism. We're not supposed to be doing that. We're supposed to try to avoid doing that. That doesn't mean that that human beings are not a priority over animals. The needs of human beings are a priority over those of animals in the animal kingdom. There's no question about that. But we don't want to unnecessarily be cruel. We have to avoid being cruel, and that is a very important commandment for God. And that's why the seventh commandment was given to Bnei Noach, which again in Hebrew is called Ever Min HaChai, which means organ from the living. It literally means organ from the living, is the literal translation from the Hebrew to the English. And again, that became relevant only after the flood. So all seven, just in to sum it up in conclusion, all seven commandments were given earlier, but the seventh one was dormant, was not applicable, and the seventh one only became relevant after the flood when people were permitted to eat animals. Thank you so much, Hrvatsky. Always fascinating questions. What great questions you ask. And now we go to our good friend Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim. What do you think of the parents who are against the mask mandates and teaching CRT in the public schools are now being labeled as domestic terrorists by the FBI? What do you think of kids being taught CRT? Thanks. Joe Gutfeld, great question. CRT, by the way, is critical race theory, and what it really means is teaching black racism against whites, stepping all over white people and blaming white people for all the problems that blacks themselves have created for themselves because of their own laziness, their own irresponsibility, their hatefulness, their jealousy. And so, and I'm not saying all blacks are like this, but the blacks who believe in CRT are like this. These are black racists who hate whites. And that's the purpose of this, to teach whites to be self-hating and step all over white people, which is all that you'd get in the school system nowadays. And all you get in the news media in Hollywood. This is all we see, that whites are put down, and certainly Jews are put down even more, and Asians are put down. Everyone is put down. Blacks, Muslims, all the lazy, ignorant, hateful, jealous, vicious, and cruel people, they're elevated. Their cultures are elevated. And so, I mean, of course this is terrible, and parents who oppose this being taught to their children are 100% right. Their children should not be brainwashed to hate white people. This is such sickness. As far as mask mandates, that's a different issue. I think that masks do prevent the disease and do prevent the coronavirus. And you know, it's a very sensitive issue for me because my mother passed away from the virus, and millions of people have died across the world from it. It's a terrible, terrible plague, and masks are proven to prevent, to be one of the things that can prevent the illness. Nothing is 100% can be 100% effective, but if something is effective in a major way and prevents a lot of illness and a lot of death and hospitalization and sickness, it's certainly worth doing. So the mask mandate, to me is a separate issue. But the CRT being taught in schools, that is something that should not be done, and parents should be resisting having their children. First of all, parents should not put their children in public schools. Public schools are an atrocity. They're controlled by the communist teachers' unions. No child should go to public schools. Public schools automatically teach lies and brainwash and destroy children's souls. If you want your children's soul to be destroyed, God forbid, you put your child in a public school. No one should put their children in public schools. The public school system for many years has been a force for destruction, for spiritual destruction. As far as the FBI is concerned, you ask about the FBI, for many years we in JTF and before us, the earlier Kahanist movement, we have always favored abolishing the FBI. You know, they say defund the police. Of course, you can't defund the police. You have to have funds for the police because the police are the only thing separating us from savages and barbarians. The savages and barbarians want us to defund the police so that they could rape, murder, and kill and do everything they want, you know, with wild abandon and not face any consequences. So they want us to... they want us to defund the police. But there is no need for the FBI. The FBI did not exist. An organization like the FBI did not exist for most of American history. And the United States was fine without the FBI. The United States was doing very well without the FBI. If you need to prosecute people in federal court and arrest them, there are all types of ways that federal agencies can have agents go out and do that if there's a necessity for doing that. But the FBI itself is a destructive organization, a corrupt organization, an evil organization, an immoral organization, and should not exist. Thank you very much, Joe Gutfeld. And now we go to the great Nekama, who is a really great JTFer, who writes, and I quote, Chaim, 1, why did the Back to Africa movement fail, unquote? Well, obviously because blacks don't want to go back to Africa. Why would they move? I mean, what's better, to have a Cadillac, to go on welfare and be able to buy a Cadillac, or to swing on a tree in a jungle? Of course they would rather live in the United States. They have it much better in the United States. The best thing that ever happened to them was slavery. And I'm not saying that slavery was an easy thing for them, and some slaves were mistreated. There were cases of slaves mistreated, but generally speaking, slaves in the United States had it much better than free people in Africa. So of course they don't want to go back. And it's something that will never voluntarily happen, that they're going to go back to Africa. They'll go back to Africa to live in those primitive, pathetic societies where they don't get welfare, they don't get food stamps, they don't get public housing projects. Here in the United States, the entire United States is on their hands and knees to black people for the past 50 years, giving them trillions of dollars in aid. Federal, state, city, aid, the whole country, corporate, private corporation, everybody is on their knees paying off black people, and they're never satisfied. Morenu v'Rabbeinu, Harab Meir Kahana, Zecher Tzadik v'Kadosh Livracha, Hashem Yikom Damo, our beloved Rabbi Meir Kahana, always said that the blacks and the Arabs are eternal malcontents. They are never happy. No matter what you give them, they're never satisfied. They're eternal malcontents. They're always going to complain. So of course, you know, the Back to Africa movement wasn't going to work. By the way, the Black to Africa movement, some of the people that were involved, though, even though they themselves never went, they were hypocrites, but some of the people who were involved included Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad from the Nation of Islam. Did you know that Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad from the Nation of Islam, and Farrakhan became their successor, of course, now, he's now the leader of the Nation of Islam. Did you know that they had an open alliance with George Lincoln Rockwell, the head of the American Nazi Party? There was something called the American Nazi Party, and George Lincoln Rockwell was the head of the American Nazi Party. Baruch Hashem, thank God, he was assassinated, but he was the head of that party. And they formed an open alliance. They had rallies together. They attended each other's rallies. George Lincoln Rockwell had his stormtroopers, what he called stormtroopers, attend Nation of Islam meetings with Elijah Muhammad and Farrakhan and Malcolm X. They literally had an alliance with the American Nazi Party. As much as the white Nazis and the black Nazis hate each other, they hated the Jews even more. And so, you know, that's just a little part of history that you never hear about. And yet Malcolm X, they do movies about him, glorifying him, books about him, Hollywood, the media, they love him. They name streets in New York, boulevards after him, and streets in New York after him. After a black Nazi, a black Hitler, who openly supported the American Nazi Party, who openly praised and supported the American Nazi Party, aside from saying that hating all whites and saying that all whites are blue-eyed devils and so on. And this is who is honored today in American society. I want to say something to my fellow Jews. If you don't get the message, you're blind, okay? This country is not for you. You better start preparing yourself, learning Hebrew, and preparing yourself to go back to Israel. That's my message to American Jews, because this country is finished. And now Nekama writes, and I quote, too, what is JTS position on the Haredi draft law, unquote? I'm against any draft law. I don't think people should be drafted into the Israeli army. Israel does not need the number of soldiers that they have, and there should not be a draft law. Israel needs a lean and strong military that can take out Iran's nuclear reactor, that can destroy the threat from Hezbollah in Lebanon, that can destroy other threats. But Israel does not need a draft law. Israel can survive and function even better militarily if it was an all-volunteer army. I'm in favor of an all-volunteer army. And now Nekama writes, and I quote, three, the Arabs openly fly the Nazi flag. I saw it with my own eyes when I was traveling in Yehuda, unquote. Absolutely true, and in fact that was something that was publicized in the right-wing Israeli media. The establishment Israeli media tried to cover it up. But they do openly fly the Nazi flag because they are Nazis. They're Nazis. They praise Nazis. They praise Hitler. They praise the Holocaust. They say that Hitler was wonderful, what Hitler did to the Jews during the Holocaust. This is what the Arabs say, and they make it clear that they plan to do the same thing whenever they get the chance. Whenever they have the power to do so, they're going to do the same thing, God forbid, if we give them the power to do so. Nekama now writes, four, should Israel share the COVID vaccine with the Arabs, unquote? Of course not. Of course not. Israel should not give, should not waste the COVID vaccine on the Arabs. They're enemies of the Jewish people, and they don't deserve any benefit from the state of Israel or from the Jewish people. We should not give anything to our enemies, ever. Any benefits to our enemies, ever. Thank you so much, Nekama. Your questions are always great, and you're really one of the great people in our movement. And now we go to another good friend of ours, Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, "One, was Harris picked for vice president due to affirmative action?" Unquote. Of course she was. She's unqualified. I mean, I hate to say that she's unqualified, as if Joe Biden is qualified. Joe Biden is senile. I mean, he's grossly unqualified as well. It's a complete joke what we have in the White House now. We have someone who's senile, a fuddy-duddy who doesn't know what day of the week it is or where he is or where he, you know, doesn't even know that he's president. And then we have Kamala Harris, who was picked because she's black, of course, and because she's from California and from San Francisco and was a very left-wing district attorney in San Francisco. Yeah. That's why she was picked. Binyamin now writes, and I quote, "I call her Kamala, pronounced like Ramallah, the PLO Nazi city in Samaria. What do you think of that name?" Unquote. I think it's excellent, very fitting, Binyamin. Congratulations. I think it's very fitting. I agree with you. 3, what do I think of Ted Cruz? I think Ted Cruz is a friend of the Jewish people. I think he would have been a good president for the Jewish people. He never would have proposed the suicidal peace, so-called peace plan that Donald Trump proposed, which would have created a so-called Palestinian state. I think Ted Cruz would have been a friend of the Jewish people and is still a friend of the Jewish people, and I would love to see him elected president someday. 4, Mike Huckabee. I like Mike Huckabee. I don't like the fact that he stabbed Ted Cruz in the back when Ted Cruz was running for president and supported Trump. I didn't like that. But Huckabee has been genuinely pro-Israel over the years, and so I like him. 5, Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, for those of you who don't know, is Mike Huckabee's daughter. I don't know enough really about her political views. I know that she was a spokesman for Donald Trump, but I don't know much about her political views. I'm going to reserve judgment, see what she says about Israel and about Jewish issues before I rush to judgment. 6, Kaylee McEnany. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. Boy, today is a rough program. I'm mispronouncing things left and right. Kaylee McEnany. McEnany or McEnany, as long as it's not Pickaninny. She was the blonde one, right? She was the blonde, the platinum blonde. She was, the press secretary, right, for Donald Trump. Yeah, she was his press secretary. She did her job for Donald Trump. What can I say? I didn't like Trump. I didn't think he was a good president. So of course I'm not going to be in favor of his spokespeople. I think that they were spokespeople for a bad cause. 7, Stephanie Grisham. Oh, she was also a press spokesman for Donald Trump. Okay. I get mixed up. I think she was before McEnany, right? I sometimes get mixed up who was first and who was on first, who's on second, 8, Sean Spicer. Now, I know he was first. He was the first one because Saturday Night Live did all types of things about him and so on. And I don't like these people. You know, I think that they're opportunists and phonies, and they serve whoever gives them a good job and a good position. So all 3 of these press spokesmen, I'm not, I don't like people like that. I don't think they're principled people. 9, Nikki Haley. Nikki Haley, I really can't stand. She is such a phony. She supports, first of all, a so-called Palestinian state and was pushing for the so-called two-state solution, and then making statements claiming to be pro-Israel when she was ambassador to the UN, and the Jews were so thrilled and so in love with her. This is someone who over and over again said that her goal would be to create a so-called Palestinian state, even though there are no Palestinians and there is no Palestine, and it would be national suicide for Israel. But Nikki Haley thinks that's what we really have to push for. So she's terrible for the Jews. And she's a phony, unprincipled fraud on everything else. When she was governor of South Carolina, she condemned Donald Trump and was against Donald Trump. She called him old. Remember, she made a speech against him before the South Carolina primary, and she was completely against Trump. Then all of a sudden, when he appointed her to the UN, she pretended that she's going to be for him now. But she's still, you know, she's an establishment fraud and not a conservative at all. 10. Ambassador David Melech Friedman, unquote. Really, really phony. I mean, really bad guy who claimed to be against the so-called Palestinian state, and then the minute he got a job with Donald Trump and started working for Trump, he announced he's in favor of a so-called Palestinian state. I mean, you can't get phonier than that. Terrible, terrible. And then he was supposed to be a big friend of the Jewish settlements in Judea and Samaria. Remember, he visited them. He's supposed to be a big friend. Meanwhile, while he was President Trump was pushing to freeze all building in the settlements. So they said, oh, the settlements, we're friends of the settlements, but don't you dare build. Jews are not allowed to build there. Arabs can build all over the place, but Jews are not allowed to build there because we have to have a Palestinian state. And Ambassador Friedman represented that policy, so I don't like him at all. Thank you very much, Binyamin. And now we go to someone who also asked very interesting questions. David too, who writes, and I quote, Chaim, Joe McCarthy stated, I think the Jewish people are a great race of people. If elected PM, would you rehabilitate his reputation? If no, why? No, I certainly would not. Joe McCarthy was a Nazi. And it wasn't because he was against the communists, because I hate communists. I sincerely hate communists, unlike Joe McCarthy, who was just a phony. Joe McCarthy, there was something called the Malmedy massacres, where Waffen-SS soldiers during World War II executed large numbers of American prisoners of war. They committed war crimes. You know, under international law, you're not allowed to execute prisoners of war. But the German Nazis did execute American prisoners of war. The Japanese also, by the way, committed war crimes against American prisoners of war. All types of war crimes. But anyway, in this particular incident, in the Malmedy massacres, the Waffen-SS soldiers were sentenced to death for war crimes because they slaughtered American prisoners of war. They murdered the American prisoners of war, and so they were told, now you got to pay with your life, which I think is the least that should, obviously the least that should be done to these beasts. McCarthy defended them fervently, ferociously defended the Nazi SS war criminals, and got them and helped them tremendously. He pushed for them and fought for them and helped them and did everything to help them. He made it sound like they're completely innocent. They shouldn't be punished. They were just doing their job. I mean, it was unbelievable what he did. So I'm very much against Joe McCarthy. By the way, he also carried around a copy, according to witnesses, and there was a book that was written where the witnesses attested to the fact, who knew him, that he carried around a copy of Hitler's Mein Kampf and used to say, that's the way to do it. He'd point to the book and say, that's the way to do it. He was a complete demagogue. He was a pathological liar. He was a con artist. And he hurt the cause of anti-communism. He gave a bad name to anti-communism because he accused people, just shooting from the hip, with no evidence, with nothing, just crazy accusations and inconsistent accusations that he made constantly. He hurt the cause of anti-communism. So I'm very much against Joe McCarthy. David, thank you very much. And now we go to the great Nachas, who's a very good friend of our movement, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, of all the wonderful Zmirot, which one or ones do you find to be the most inspirational, unquote. Well, I think a lot of them are very inspirational. My favorite is Tehillim Kaf Zion, which means Psalm 23, the famous psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, I think it says in English. That was written by David HaMelech, by King David. He never lost hope. He was in situation, first of all, for the first like 29 years of his life, he was in very bad situations, until he was 30 years old, until he became king, in fact. Until he became king, he was in a very bad situation, always. First he was rejected and an outcast in his own family. Then, even after that, Shaul, the first king of Israel, wanted to kill him, wanted to murder him, was jealous of him because of him killing Goliath in that battle, and the Jewish people giving him credit for doing that, and the Jewish people loving him and wanting him as a leader. And Shaul, the first king of Israel, knew that and was very jealous of him and spent years hunting him and trying to kill him. So David was constantly running to try to save himself from being killed. In many cases, he came very close to death. He lived a very difficult, painful life. At one point, he hid his parents in the kingdom of Moab, and the Moabite king murdered his parents and murdered his family. Murdered his parents and his family, and only one of his brothers escaped to tell about it. So he lived a very, very rough life, David. Terrible, terrible tragedies in his life. Then he became king, and then as king, his own son, Avshalom, rebelled against him and removed him from power temporarily. And he had to leave Yerushalayim and was removed from power temporarily. And then his son died in the battle. And they had a battle later, and his son died. You know, when this happens to your own son and your parents and your family, and you have all this death around you among the people that you love very much, and when you have to flee for your own life all this time, I mean, he lived a life of tremendous suffering. And yet he always believed in Hashem and never gave up and always had complete faith and always turned to Hashem. That's a great story. And that's the story of Psalm 23. Psalm 23 symbolizes it. It's one of the Zmirot that we sing on Motzei Shabbat. It's one of the things we sing on Motzei Shabbat. Motzei Shabbat means Saturday night after Shabbat. Thank you very much, Nachos. And now we go to Yimach Shmo to Islam. Another great JTFer whom we haven't seen for, I haven't seen you for a while, Yimach Shmo to Islam. It's good to see you again. Yimach Shmo to Islam writes, and I quote, "Der Chaim, are people foolish to refuse to accept the vaccine?" Unquote. Of course they are. Of course it's foolish to refuse to accept the vaccine. Let me put it this way. Over 90% of the hospitalized people in Israel are unvaccinated, even though only 20% of the adult population in Israel is unvaccinated. Over 90% of the adults who are in hospitals are unvaccinated, but only 20% of the population is unvaccinated. So it should be 20% is unvaccinated. If it was all proportional, if the vaccine didn't make a difference, it would be 20% would be the people who are being hospitalized, and 20% of the people who die of the vaccine would also be unvaccinated, right? But out of that 20% unvaccinated, they are over 90% of the deaths, and over 90% of the people who are hospitalized with serious illness. I mean, you got to be blind not to see this. And by the way, the statistics are similar in the United States and in Europe and everywhere else. Everywhere else in the Western world where you have effective vaccines. I'm not talking about the Sputnik vaccine in Russia or the Chinese or Indian vaccine. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about real vaccines. Where you have real vaccines, Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, where people take real vaccines, the unvaccinated are far more likely to get ill, far more likely to die. And so, of course, it's foolish not to take the vaccine. Of course it is. It's crazy. Thank you so much, Yimach Shmo to Islam. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, who always asks the greatest questions. And Dr. Dan asks, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, a reason why you think good things happen to bad people and bad things to good people. What does Judaism say about that?" Unquote. That is one of the classic... You see what I mean? I told you Dr. Dan always asks great questions. That is one of the classic questions of Judaism. And it's a question which Moshe Rabbeinu, which Moses asked of God. And it's a question which is the subject of the book of Iyov. Iyov is how do you say Iyov? Job. Job? Am I saying Job in English? Yeah, Iyov in Hebrew. Why do good people suffer sometimes and bad people sometimes prosper? Why does this happen? What's going on here? And the first answer is because if we didn't have that, we wouldn't have free will. We wouldn't have Bechira Chofshit, which means free will. if everybody who did good was automatically rewarded and everybody who did bad was automatically punished, everybody would do good automatically because nobody would want to get punished. If the minute you did something bad, a big hammer would come and hit you and smack you and you don't want to feel pain, you don't want to be punished, so you would never sin again. So of course we can't have a situation where you're rewarded automatically when you do good and punished automatically when you do bad. In this world, by the way, in the next world, that is what happens. The next world, it's midah keneged midah. This, you have a different system completely. In the next world, which is the world of truth, this is the world of lies. This is alma deshikra, the world of lies. But the next world is the world of truth. In the next world, midah keneged midah, which means measure for measure, we're going to be punished and or rewarded for every single deed and every level. And every intention and what our intention was when we did various deeds or when we thought thoughts or when we everything will be measure for measure down to the minutest detail in the next world. There's going to be perfect justice with mercy, of course, but with mercy for those who are merciful. If someone is merciful, then God is merciful toward them. If someone is merciless and an evil beast, then God is not... God can't show mercy to someone who's merciless, who shows no mercy to others. But anyway, so we have perfect justice in the next world. In this world, we don't, because we have to have a situation like this in order to have free will. Now, bad things happen to good people. You have even good people sin. Everybody sins. Judaism is not like Christianity, which says the Pope is infallible, or other religion. I mean, I'm talking about real Judaism. I'm not talking about people who believe that they have rebbes who never sin. I'm talking about real classic Judaism. We read in the Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu did things that displeased God at times. That there were things that even Moses did that displeased God. Moses was the greatest human being ever to live. He's the one who gave us the Torah. And the greatest prophet ever. And we know that King David, that even he made mistakes in life and even he sinned. And King David is the king that God loves so much and compares every other king to David and says, like, he did good in the eyes of God, like my servant David, or he did not do good in the eyes of God. He was evil and was not like my servant David. God compares every other king to my servant David. He loved David. And so David was a very righteous king and a very righteous human being. And yet, even King David committed sins. Now, and the Bible doesn't hide this. The Judaism makes it clear that human beings are human beings. Even the greatest human beings sometimes have faults and commit sins. And so bad things will happen to good people sometimes. Why? So that they suffer in this world. Then they'll have no suffering in the next world. In other words, they pay the price here, and in the next world there's no suffering for them. It's all clean. That cleans up their record for them. One of the reasons King David only lived to the age of 70, and one of the reasons why when he was in his 60s he was very sick and he had tremendous suffering and pain and suffering in his life. And we mentioned some of it in an earlier question. This cleanses people of... Because even good people have some sins, and God wants the good people to go into the next world with a completely clean record so that they can immediately go to paradise and immediately get their reward. So bad things that happen to good people are to cleanse their records and make sure that they go into the next world and don't have to face punishment and don't have to face judgment for the mistakes they made in this world. Good things, on the other hand, the opposite. Good things happening to bad people. When good things happen to bad people... By the way, bad things also happen to bad people and good things also happen to good people. But that's logical, that we understand. Why? If you're bad, bad things will happen. If you're good, good things will happen. That we know. There are four possibilities, right? Good things can happen to good people. Bad things happen to bad people. Those two are logical. But then bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people. Those are the next two things that can happen in the world. And that is something that goes against what we would expect from a loving, merciful, just God. But there are reasons for that. And it's part of his mercy and justice and truthfulness that creates a world like this. So why do good things happen for bad people? Why do bad people prosper in this world sometimes? Some of that is also to maintain free will, but some of that is also because even bad people do good things sometimes. And if they're really, really evil, but they did certain good things, God doesn't want to give them reward in the next world if they were really viciously evil, if they did terrible things, which many people are. There are many people who are viciously evil and cruel and don't care about anybody else. And people who are like that, they have some good things happening to them in this world sometimes. That's so that they get their reward in this world. In the next world, they get no reward because they already got their reward here. When they go to the next world, they're going to say, when God says, why did you murder this person? Why did you commit rape? Why did you steal? Why did you hate the Jews? Why did you want to do harm to the Jewish people or harm to innocent people? Why did you do, you know, all the other why did you have these terrible thoughts about, why were you so cruel to your children? And so on, all these other things that many, many people are guilty of. When God asks them this question on Yom HaDin, on the Day of Judgment, they're going to say, yes, okay, that's true, but I also did some good things. Look what I did. I gave to this charity, I did this, I did that. And God's going to say, yeah, you did that, but you already got your reward for that. I let you live. I let you succeed in the stock market. I let you succeed with your investments. I let you have a nice home or a nice car. You know, you already got your rewards for that. So they have nothing coming in the next world. That's another reason. Thank you very much, Dr. Dan, for an excellent question as always. And now we go to our other good friend, Italian Zionist, who writes, and I quote, I was interested in the temple history and came across the following. In 363 CE, the Roman Emperor Julian had ordered Alypius of Antioch to rebuild the temple as part of his campaign to strengthen non-Christian religions. What do you know about this? Why was it never rebuilt for 2,000 years? Unquote. You know, Italian Zionists, you're educating me. I didn't know about this. I did not know that there was a Roman emperor who gave the order to rebuild the temple. I knew nothing about this, so I'm getting an education. Thank you. You're giving me interesting facts here. The temple was not rebuilt. First of all, for the temple to be rebuilt, the Jews had to be in control of the land of Israel again, and they haven't been for 2,000 years. The question is, why hasn't the temple been rebuilt since 1948, when the Jews do have their own country? They didn't have Jerusalem. They didn't have Yerushalayim, the section of Jerusalem where the temple has to be built. But since 1967, okay, for the past 54 years, for the past 50, I just added it up from 1967 to now, for the past 54 years, the Jews do have Jerusalem and could rebuild the temple, but they don't want to. And that's a sin and a tragedy, and hopefully that situation will change. Thank you so much, Italian Zionist, and we go now to the great Chabad Kahanist, who writes, and I quote, what do you think of the vile Jew-hating spooks that call themselves Hebrew Israelites? Unquote. Well, of course they're ignorant, stupid, smelly, low-life, primitive morons. I remember that they had a show. I had my cable TV show in Manhattan and in Queens. For many years, I had a program on cable TV with a very big audience. Rush Limbaugh used to watch the show. He said, I'll never watch 60 Minutes again because we were opposite 60 Minutes in Manhattan. The E! Channel called our show the most riveting show on cable television in the 1990s. I mean, we had one hell of a show. Because obviously we said things that nobody else would say. And the black Hebrews were so angry. They wanted to have a show right after our show so that they could curse me out and say things on the show. So we had our show, and right after that they gave a slot to the black Hebrews to come on the air and curse us out. By the way, the reason we had a television show is because under the law, they had to give it to whoever applies, you have access to cable television. And then in the end, they discriminated against us. Anyway, long story, but getting back to black Hebrews. So they came on the show, and the black Hebrew comes on, and one of their spokesmen who come on dressed. I don't know, they think that this is the way a Hebrew is supposed to be dressed. And just ignorant, stupid, sick morons. and they come on the show and start screaming, "Nigga, you know," speaking about me, he's talking about me, "Nigga, you ain't got nothing, nigga, you know nothing, nigga, you been down to nigga, and you know," and then with dirty language also, with obscene language also, which I'm not going to repeat, of course, but dirty language and saying, "Nigga this and nigga that," and they kept calling me nigger, nigger, nigger. So I went on the show next week and I said, "Why do you keep calling me nigger? I'm not a nigger. I'm not black." And that got them even more outraged. And then I went on and I said, "And I am such a civil rights leader, I don't even use the word nigger on the air." And in fact, I said, "I don't even use the word nigger when I'm speaking to one." So I was trying to be a civil rights leader. I'm trying to, you know, they didn't appreciate it. And, you know, so much for that. But I'll say one thing, though. They were scared to death whenever I would go to the cable station. They were so scared because they knew that I was a convicted bomber. And so one time I left a package for a second on the floor so that I could look for something in my briefcase. And I left the package on the floor, and they saw the package there, and everybody backed away from the package. They said, "Ooh, he left something on the floor." They thought I'm leaving a bomb on the floor. I mean, the imagination of these people is unbelievable. But whenever I would go to the cable station, I was the one Jewish program where they were so worried that we were going to do something to their station, and it was unbelievable. But anyway, the black Hebrews are people with no history, are people who were swinging from trees, and so they hate people who do have a history, and so they try to steal other people's history. Thank you very much, Chabad Kahanist. And now we go to Noah Hyde, who always has great questions and who writes, and I quote, "Please comment, 1, New York City of today versus New York City of your youth," unquote. Well, New York City today is a nightmare. High crime, lots of drugs, immorality. It's a very, very bad place today. I don't recognize the city. When I was younger, the city was predominant. There were three groups that dominated in the city. The city, first of all, the city was 25% Jewish. New York City, one out of every four New Yorkers was a Jew in the 1950s, 1960s. And then that changed. The Jews started moving out. But New York City had a lot of Jews and a lot of Irish and Italians. And it was a city with a lot of middle-class communities, a city with all type. It was a very active, exciting place to live all the time. There was constant action and energy and creativity in the city. Brilliant people. The city colleges and the city universities were all Jewish kids who were brilliant, who were geniuses. I mean, some of the best. They went to city colleges, which were public colleges, public colleges. But because they were filled with Jewish students, who of course are very smart, they turned it into some of the best colleges in the world, where they were turning out more scientists than the leading universities with these Jewish kids. And that's the type of city I saw, a city with creativity and brilliance, and middle-class neighborhoods and family life. That was the city I knew. The city of now, all of that is gone. And Noah Hyde writes, and I quote, 2, your favorite borough and and neighborhood, excuse me, unquote. Well, my favorite borough is probably Brooklyn. Might surprise some people, but it is my favorite borough. By the way, in Brooklyn, a quarter of the people in Brooklyn are still Jewish. They still have 25% of the population. That's the one borough where you still have 25% of the population is Jewish. But I like, if I had to pick a borough, I want to live only in the land of Israel. I don't want to live anywhere outside of Israel. But if I'm forced to live outside of Israel, the borough, even though I don't live in Brooklyn now, that would probably be my favorite borough. When I was a child, I grew up in Sheepshead Bay, which is in southern Brooklyn, and that would probably be my favorite neighborhood. Thank you very much, Noah Hyde. And now we go to the great Kahana Was Right BT, who writes, and I quote, 1, Hi, Chaim. You mentioned last week that your father, Alav HaShalom, was from Warsaw. When did he get out? What was his experience like to live there? And what is the story behind how that side of your family made it to America? Unquote. Okay. For me, it's an interesting question because it involves my family. My father and the people on that side of the family did not want to talk about what happened in Europe. My father, and my grandparents, they did not go to the concentration camps. They got out of Europe before the Holocaust and before the Germans came into Poland. The exact year, I got different stories from my father and from my aunt, my father's sister. I got different stories from them. I don't know who's what or what. I don't know. They did not want to discuss it. They never wanted to speak to me about it. It was very traumatic to them, whatever happened there. They had a business there and they had other things there. They lost everything. And they went to Latin America. They didn't come to the United States directly. They went to Latin America and lived in Latin America for at least 10 years. And from the 1930s to the 1940s. And that's why my father spoke fluent, perfect Spanish with no accent, perfect, well-educated Spanish. And then from there they came to the United States. But the details behind the story and the exact years when they came, even though I was very curious and my sister really wanted to find out, but they just wouldn't. We got contradictory stories because they didn't really want to open up. It was very painful for them and they didn't like discussing it. It was very painful. Second question from Kahana was right is two. Could you give your thoughts on the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, unquote? Well, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising was an uprising where 40,000, 30,000 Jews, different estimates of how many were left, 30,000, 40,000, 50,000, who were starving, who had almost nothing, with their bare hands practically, built firebombs and resisted the German Nazi attempt to move them, to destroy them and move them to concentration camps. It was the one place where the Jews, one place in Warsaw and in Poland where the Jews really violently resisted. Actually, in Poland there may have been some other places where there was some resistance. But the Warsaw Ghetto showed how Jews can fight back, can be very heroic, and with nothing. They had none. They fought against the modern German army. The 50,000 starving Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto held out longer against Nazi Germany than the nation of France, which had a bigger standing army than the German army. The French army was bigger than the German army, and the French surrendered almost immediately. The Warsaw Ghetto held out longer than France. The Warsaw Ghetto, this is a neighborhood in Warsaw. With nothing, without weapons, without training, without military training, with nothing. They held out longer than the Polish army did. Polish army, they went into battle with horses on horseback against tanks. So, you know. But anyway, and it was a story where the Jews didn't even fight together. The left-wing Jews refused to fight next to the right-wing Jews. The right-wing Jews wanted everybody to fight together, the right-wing Jabotinsky Jews, but the left-wing Jews, the sick, self-hating left-wing Jews, the socialist Jews, who today are hailed as the heroes of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, of course, they get all the credit because all the historians are all, and all the money people, and all the funders of Holocaust history and so on are all self-hating, assimilated, intermarried Jews, and generally speaking, they're the ones that fund everything in universities and everywhere else. So the credit is always given to the socialist left-wing Jews. But it was the right-wing Jabotinsky Jews who were armed and who were ready to fight back. They at least had some arms. And they wanted to fight everybody to fight together. And if they had fought together, if they weren't against each other and they had all fought together, they would have delivered even greater blows to the German army. And they did deliver blows to the German army. They killed They killed, I don't remember the exact number, but they killed German soldiers and destroyed German tanks and German weaponry. And the Germans were bogged down there for weeks trying to uproot these brave, heroic resistors. So there are many lessons to learn from the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, but one of them certainly is that Jews should be armed. Another is that Jews shouldn't live in the galut, in the exile at all, to begin with. Another is that when Jews are facing their enemies, they have to unite and fight together. So there are many lessons to be learned from the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Thank you, Kahana was right. And now we go to another good friend for a long time of our movement, angry Chinese Kahanist, who writes, and I quote, "How do you feel right now after your recovery?" Unquote. Well, I feel much better than I did. I really had the coronavirus pretty badly. I didn't go to the hospital. I was not hospitalized, but for weeks, every night when I went to sleep, I would wake up in the middle of the night, sometimes several times during the night, with cold sweats. I had to have a change of clothes near my bed because I knew I was going to wake up sweating. So I had fever at night for several weeks. That was one of the after effects. In addition to that, I lost most of my sense of taste. I used to love eating certain types, especially fruits and, I love fruits and vegetables, and certain types of foods I used to love to eat. And I only eat healthy food, but there were certain types of spices and fruits and vegetables and other things that I love to eat. Now, I don't enjoy it as much. I have some sense of taste, but it's not what it was. It's changed. I lost some of my sense of taste as a result of the coronavirus. But other than that, I think I fully recovered. Other than the fact that I still have a loss of taste, I feel pretty normal aside from that. An angry Chinese Kahanist writes now, and I quote, "Would you still consider running for the Knesset if you were let into Israel?" Unquote. They would never allow me to. They would never allow me to. Even people who sold out, they're so fascistic. People like Baruch Marzel and Michael Ben-Ari, who sold out, who told them, "We changed, we apologize, we're different now." They were barred from running. They've been barred from running. So what do you think they're going to do for me, someone who will not say that I've changed, that I'm not, that, you know, that I apologize and that I'm no longer supporting Rabbi Kahana and the things that Baruch Marzel and Michael Ben-Ari were willing to say? I'd never say that. And so of course they're not going to let me run, unless there's some gigantic change, unless Hashem, God, miraculously creates some gigantic change. They would never let me run for the Knesset. If they would be a different story, then yes, I would. If they would let me run, but under present circumstances, they never allow me. They're not even allowing me in there, and they certainly would not allow me to run for the Knesset. Thank you, angry Chinese Kahanist. And now we go to another friend of ours for years now, Chicago Jew, who writes, and I quote, "Your opinion of Mark Levin," unquote. Oh, I can't stand him. I don't know if it was Deputy Attorney General or Assistant Attorney General. I don't know if it was Deputy or Assistant. I don't remember which, and I don't even really know the differences between Deputy and Assistant. I don't know which is more important, which is not more important. But he was working I'm not even sure if it was one of those two positions, but I know that he worked in the Justice Department under Edwin Meese in the 1980s. During the Reagan administration, when they prosecuted Jonathan Pollard in that terrible miscarriage of justice they did to Pollard, when they promised him that they weren't going to recommend a heavy sentence, and that, you know, that he was almost assured that he's going to get a light sentence, and they gave him life, and the judge recommended without parole, a black Jew-hating judge that thankfully is dead now, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, recommended life against him, recommended he never be paroled, and he wound up doing 30 years in prison and 5 years on parole. 35 years he was punished for doing something which he should have gotten a medal for, which is because what he did helped Israel and America, benefited both countries, providing Israel with information about Arab terrorists and about Arab Muslim enemies was good for America and good for Israel. But Mark Levin had no problem with the prosecution of Pollard. Never had any problem with any of that. And later, as a talk show host on the radio, when he was asked about Pollard numerous times, people called him and asked him, and he refused. He refused to say that he was for freeing Pollard at a time when many Gentiles, Gentile politicians, Gentile leaders, were coming out and making statements saying that he should be free. Gentile clergy were coming out and saying that he should be free. And Mark Levin, this cowardly, lowlife, wimpy, self-hating Jew, wouldn't come out and say that he freed Jonathan Pollard, that we should free Jonathan Pollard, to at least atone a little bit for the terrible crime he committed serving in the Justice Department that did this to his fellow Jew, Jonathan Pollard, who was a Jew a million times better than he would ever be, than Mark Levin would ever be. So I can't stand him. He's scum. Scum. And his, you know, and he pretends to be pro-Israel now, first of all, because it's in his interest, because his base includes evangelical Christians, but it's a complete, complete phony of pro-Israel. What does pro-Israel mean? He supported the Trump proposed deal to create a so-called Palestinian state, which would be national suicide for Israel. So with friends like him, Israel doesn't need any enemies. I can't stand him. I can't stand him. And like so many other things in our society, he's considered to be pro-Israel, and what he's considered to be is not the case, is not true. Thank you, Chicago Jew, and I want to thank everybody for another program, for another AskJTF program that I certainly enjoy doing. And I look forward again to being with our great JTFers next week. Bezrat Hashem, God willing, if we work together as a team, we can make this a better world and we can change Jewish history. For JTF, until next week, this is Chaim Ben Pesach. Shalom.